Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jean Sibelius grew up in the age of romantic nationalism in Finland, an era of struggle for freedom from Imperial Russia. His music, Finlandia and Beyond, made him an icon of the North in the company of Scandinavians, Ibsen and Grieg, Strindberg and Munch. Some swooned for his music, some hated it. He's back in the spotlight at the Bard Music Festival. This hour on Point, Sibelius, voice of Finland, and the idea of the North. You can join the conversation. Do you whistle, Sibelius, Finlandia? Smell the fresh snow? Is this your old country sound, or far from it? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Albany, New York, is the co-artistic director at the Bard Summerscape Music Festival, Christopher Gibbs, professor of music at Bard College in Annandale-on-Hudson, New York, editor of for the Musical Quarterly. He's running the show at this and last week's festival celebrating Jean Sibelius and his world. Christopher Gibbs, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And also in Albany is professor of music at Oxford University, Daniel Grimley, scholar in residence at Bard's Music Festival. His work focuses on classical music of the far north. He's an editor for the academic journal Music and Letters, and his new book is Sibelius and His World. Daniel Grimley, welcome to On Point. Great to have you both here.
Hi, Tom. Very nice to be here.
So, wow, we got the big timpani there and the big sound right at the beginning. That was, of course, part of Finlandia. There are better-known parts, and we'll hear those as well, incredibly well-known parts. I mean, it's so well-known that at this point, even though Finland is not technically part of Scandinavia, though Sweden, which certainly is, ruled over Finland for many, many centuries, for an awful lot of people, Sibelius is the sound of that Northland. How did that come to be, Daniel Grimley?
Well, Sibelius belongs to a very particular historical moment. He came to maturity as an artist precisely at the point when Finland was first starting to define itself as a nascent independent nation state. And of course, his music then had immediate international appeal. It was heard all the way across Europe with hit tunes such as Finlandia and Valstriest. So for many people, he instantly came to define the sound of the North.
And that is a sound, what? It makes people talk about ice and wind and snow and pine and birch and all the rest. A lot of nature woven in here.
That's right. It's incredibly visual music. So Sibelius knew many painters, photographers were among his friends. And when people heard this stuff, his music immediately brought to mind images of the Finnish landscape, its people, its architecture, and the whole northern domain.
Christopher Gibbs, he was incredibly popular in this country in the 1930s. Not everybody liked him. Aaron Copland, no way. Glenn Gould loved him. People were all over the map on Sibelius. But what about the arc of his popularity and where it stands now? Why have you brought him back at the Bard Music Festival?
Well, we felt it was time to reassess. As you say, there was not just great popularity, but as well really fierce attacks. It almost was an overreaction on both sides. The chief critic of the New York Times was saying that this was the great composer after Beethoven, and there was a brief pamphlet written in French by one of Schoenberg's students called Sibelius, the worst composer in the world.
Sounds like Keith Olbermann.
So, I mean, the debates were really intense, but at the same time, with audiences, they were really embracing the music, particularly, as you say, by the 1930s. And so just the sheer number of performances and also really the leading conductors, Toscanini and Koussevitzky and Stokowski, were performing and recording his music all the time.
Let's listen to a little more, and then we'll dive into that intense debate over this northern composer. Here is from one of his earliest major symphonic works, Sibelius's Kullervo. Tells the story of the protagonist of the same name in the Finnish epic Kauvala. Forgive me if my pronunciation is not right here, but this is sort of the deep ancient national epic. This recording is from just last week at Bard with Leon Botstein and the American Symphony Orchestra. Early work there from Sibelius, directed just last week by Leon Botstein at the Bard Music Festival. Daniel Grimley, begin to take us into the debate over Sibelius. So what was at the heart of it in musical circles?
Well, it's to do with ideas of ownership and on whose behalf Sibelius is really speaking here. And what's remarkable about Kullervo is that this is a work from right at the start of Sibelius' career. He's only 27 when he writes it. And what knocked its audience sideways when they heard it for the first time was just the sheer impact of hearing the Finnish language sung by this powerful male voice choir. And these epic chords in the orchestra and these runic melodies, melodies inspired by Finnish folk music. So Sibelius was really stamping Finnish identity upon the world through this work.
So
then, of course, there's... As that debate developed and as demands for Finnish independence grew, then those kind of claims of ownership became increasingly contentious.
There was a political debate then. This is nationalism right there in the symphony and romantic nationalism, no question about it. But he ran, Christopher Gibbs, right into the era when Stravinsky and Schoenberg and many others were taking us off in quite atonal directions. You know, looking back, it looks as though the critics saw him as a kind of reactionary hanging on to an older style.
Yes, well, that's the burgeoning modernism was taking music really bold and unusual new ways, but in some ways nationalist as well. Schoenberg famously said that he was inventing new techniques of atonal and then 12-tone music that would secure the future of German music for the next 100 years. Stravinsky was coming out of Russia and trying to mold that with a French identity. So actually the nationalist agenda for all the composers was quite strong at the time, and what's interesting to compare is how different it can sound and how it can, as you say, have a lush romantic flavor to it or something that seems shockingly dissonant and not very listener-friendly.
Many strands of nationalism at work here, including at one point we'll talk about a little Third Reich admiration for Sibelius, but it seems cruel to mention up against the sound, the really peaceful part of Finlandia dying down from that bombastic orchestral struggle we heard at the top of the hour. Here it settles into the famous calm of a hymn that would later become one of Finland's most important national songs.
Thank you.
Christopher Gibbs, there's the little bit of Sibelius I grew up with. And in my little corner of the world, it was all about peace.
Yes, well, there are hymn versions and different words that have been put to it, but it is the most famous melody to come from Sibelius. And what's interesting, as you can hear in the recording you're playing, is that a piece that we now know purely orchestrally was premiered with these nationalist words of how Finland should arise and how it will be victorious.
That we now know purely orchestrally. On the other hand, we know it vocally very well. There was a popular sort of rendition of this that came later with Peter, Paul, and Mary and Joan Baez and "Oh, Hear My Prayer, O God of All the Nations, a Song of Peace for Their Lands and Mine." Many lyrics have been put to this over the years, Daniel Grimley, but a powerful statement, not only of Finnish character, but a call for peace in this piece.
That's right. Well, this is the kind of tune which reaches for universal associations. That's what hymns of patriotic pride do, and that's precisely where these issues of collectivity and ownership become so difficult to pin down precisely.
We'll come back and look at collectivity and ownership, Jean Sibelius, and a career from the North. Let's go out of this segment with the Violin Concerto in D minor. This is Movement 3. Daniel Grimley joins us today, author of editor of Sibelius and His World. Christopher Gibbs is with us from the Bard Music Festival. We're talking about the music of Jean Sibelius. You can join us, 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the music of Jean Sibelius, voice of Finland and the North. You can join the conversation. Do you know Sibelius? Is he your family ethnic soundtrack, or far from it? Do you know him beyond Finlandia? Does he make you see ice and birch trees, snow and pine? Do you love the romantic nationalism in Sibelius, or does it put you right off? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. The Bard Summerscape Music Festival has embraced Sibelius this season and is doing performances of many of his works in their big annual round of celebration and performance. Christopher Gibbs is with us from Bard College, professor of music there, co-artistic director of the Bard Summerscape Music Festival. On right now, he's author of The Life of Schubert. He's also editor for the Musical Quarterly. And Daniel Grimley is with us, professor of music at Oxford University, scholar in residence at the Bard Music Festival, and editor of Sibelius and His World. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Christopher Gibbs, what is this right behind us here? We've got Symphony 1.
The first symphony, yes. What we were hearing earlier with the Kullervo symphony, maybe we could call symphony number zero.
Yes.
And although it had a great success, Sibelius suppressed the work and it was not heard again in his lifetime. It was only published after his death. But now this first symphony, there are seven numbered symphonies, mm-hmm. and this as well had considerable success. It comes more out of maybe even the Russian tradition. Sounds a little bit like Tchaikovsky at various moments.
Yeah. Yes, indeed it does. Let's get our listeners right in here from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill is calling. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Two pieces of Sibelius's music, I can't believe you haven't mentioned them yet. They're tremendous. One, I believe, is called The Swan of Tuonela. The legend behind it is that I guess Tuonela is the entrance to Hades, or the Norse equivalent of Hades.
Hades, yeah.
And there's
mm-hmm.
a lake in front of it, and there's this black swan that swims around it. You know, with Sibelius, you have this crashing music. Well, various instruments. But with that particular piece of music, it's hauntingly unforgettable. And there's also another piece of music. I don't know the name to this at all. But it's a waltz that Sibelius composed. But it's like no waltz that you've ever heard in your entire life. The background to that is this woman is on her deathbed, and she's relating a ball that she went to. So you're basically, in this piece of music, going through her memory and going back to the memory, to that particular ball. And you're listening to this waltz, and you know it's a waltz, but it's not, you know, it's not a happy waltz. It's, again, it's a type of waltz that is like no waltz I've ever heard before or since, and you cannot forget it.
Bill, let us pick it up right there. You've got a lot in our ears, and I appreciate your call. Christopher Gibbs, first to we're going to hear not Tuonela, but Tapiola later in this hour. Tuonela and the story at the mouth of Hades, do you know it, Christopher?
Yes, well, and the Bill is absolutely right of the descriptions of both pieces, the utter calm of this Suona Tuonela, and then the valse triste, the sad waltz that is a waltz like no other. It's very identifiably a waltz, but mixes in moments of gaiety with incredible sadness and nostalgia, and indeed the word haunting is appropriate for both of these pieces.
Daniel Grimley, what brings that sense of haunting mystery to Sibelius's work?
Well, it's a kind of melodic tone, I think, this particular modal intonation that Sibelius uses, which gives his music this very special atmosphere. And it's also the evocation of a kind of lost or distant world. So that you often feel in Sibelius's music that there's something which you can glimpse but is always out of reach.
Let's go to Mary in Simsbury, Connecticut. Mary, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Mary. Are you there?
Hello, Tom.
Hi, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm from Finland, so it's Swan of Tuonela.
Thank you very much. Tuonela.
Tuonela.
Yes.
Tuonela is like Hades, but it's more like death and kind of a non-place that you wind up.
You're from Finland. How did you grow up with Sibelius? What presence did he have in your household?
Strangely enough, my grandfather's town, I'm from Loviisa, Finland, which is in the east of Helsinki, and my grandfather, who was actually a Jaeger and a national hero, he owned a property where Sibelius spent summers, and he composed Finlandia at one of our homes that we own in Loviisa, Finland.
Wow,
and my grandfather was
amazing.
Very thrilled to have Sibelius as his house guest or his tenant for that summer, because it had been a couple of years after the First World War, and if you know Finnish history, there were 102 Jaegers who formed an army. They were trained in Germany prior to World War II.
What was a Jaeger, Mary? What was a Jaeger? It's a family name, but
Sibelius's work is really tied to the whole independence movement and the national sort of pride and reawakening of Finland, not just to identify themselves from Sweden, but also to fight the sort of socialist Russia.
Yeah, Mary, I'm sorry to hang up on it, but let me ask you, what was a Jaeger? I know that as a family name, but what did it mean in Finland?
Tuonela?
No, Jaeger. Was that a soldier?
Jaeger?
A revolutionary?
A
rebel?
Like a West Point cadet.
Oh,
basically.
I see.
Jaeger.
Yeah.
As in German.
And for
the German language.
And
Jaeger. Jaegers were like West Point cadets, basically, who were trained. You know, Finland, Grand Duchy of Russia, allowed Finland to have their language and parliament, but it allowed a kind of a secret movement of either high-born Finns or very motivated young men like my grandfather, who then traveled to Germany to be trained so they could take over the country because they were already feeling that Russia was in the process of collapsing.
Yeah. Yeah, Mary, it's amazing to hear from the granddaughter of the man who owned the place where Finlandia itself was written, and I very much appreciate your call. Daniel Grimley, I think it's hard for folks outside Finland to understand just how enormous a position Sibelius holds in that country. Give us a sense of the dimensions of his stature.
Well, he was so famous that he appeared on Finnish money for many years. And when he finally died in 1957, his funeral was a huge state affair. It was the largest event that had been held in Finland for many years. So he was really regarded as a national treasure.
And remains so to this day. Let's hear more from Sibelius. Here's Symphony 3. This is sort of floating between the late romantic period, romance of his first two symphonies and the austere nuance of his later works. This is a third symphony in C major, opens in the first movement with strong rhythmic melodies that unfold over a strange dissonance in the horns. No dissonance right there. You've got that kind of happy bird in the woods sound floating through there. Christopher Gibbs, I mean, this, you can trace this back to Beethoven and Mozart, and you can hear the family. This is anything but the dissonance that would come with Schoenberg, and for that matter, the kind of recreation of symphony that we would hear in Mahler. Did Sibelius see himself as standing by old ways or not, Christopher?
I think in many ways he did, and this symphony, the third symphony, is maybe the Ugly Duckling. It's, I think, the least often performed, but mm-hmm. It is just a fantastic work. We did it last weekend and sort of wanted to advocate for this piece. But the orchestra, for example, is not very large, certainly in comparison to what Mahler is doing at this time, but also what Richard Strauss and Schoenberg is doing. It's much more of a Beethovenian size orchestra, and classical forms, so much more familiar in this respect.
What do you mean when you say Ugly Duckling, but also fantastic?
Well, that's just in terms of its exposure. One of the, you know, seven symphonies, one of them has to be the least played, and it's always sort of surprised me that the third symphony is the one that gets ignored, because it really is a terrific symphony. One of them has to be the least performed. One of them has to be the most performed. It's just the way things are. Beethoven's Fourth Symphony is his Ugly Duckling. It's the least often done.
Just for comparison, let's pull that one down and put it up against some Mahler, written at almost the same time. Mahler's Symphony Number 8, and this Eighth Symphony was written in 1906, just a year before Sibelius's Third. It's known to many as Mahler's Symphony of 1,000. It's a massive orchestra and bombastic vocal textures, worlds apart from the condensed sounds of the Finnish composer. Just for comparison, to have a sense in time of these two, where they were going, here's Mahler, Eighth Symphony. Daniel Grimley, there goes Mahler. And we're up in an entirely kind of different scale and realm here. These two actually talked and met, took a long walk at the very least together. What about the relationship between the music of these two men, the actual physical, personal relationship? I don't mean physical, but personal relationship, Daniel.
That's right. Well, they take this famous stroll in 1907, just as Sibelius is putting the finishing touches to that third symphony. And, well, they are very different kinds of individuals, of course. Gustav Mahler was the leading conductor-composer of his generation, an international superstar. And Sibelius at this moment is just cutting his teeth, a national hero, but not yet fully formed on the international stage. And they have diametrically opposed ideas of what the symphony should do. For Mahler, it's still trying to encompass the whole world. But Sibelius talks about the symphony as the crystallization of thought from chaos and admires its profound logic.
Let's go to Jeff in Long Lake, New York. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's interesting. I went to a boys' YMCA camp on Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
I was a camper there in the 50s and became a counselor in the 60s. Finlandia was adapted and became the camp hymn. I think right from the beginning, our chaplain at the camp was, which goes back to 1929, was a Protestant minister, and he wrote the words to it. The words were what made my ears perk up when I was first listening to the program. Mm-hmm. The opening lines are, "We lift our hearts to Northwood's glorious beauty and to the pines that tower over all."
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this became a real staple. Many, many words put to this. You go back in the 60s, Peter, Paul, and Mary were singing it. The Indigo Girls sang it later. Just for a sense of how popular that was and is, different names given it. This is my song. Here's Joan Baez live in the Bowery Ballroom in New York in 2005 with the This Is My Song version of Sibelius's Finlandia.
This is my song, thou God of all the nations, a song of peace for lands afar and mine. This is my home, the country where my heart is. Here are my hopes, my dreams, my holy shrine.
Christopher Gibbs, what do you think Sibelius would have thought of his work there at campfires around the world and with Peter, Paul, and Mary? And, I mean, he lived a long time into the 1950s, but not long enough to hear that revival. What do you think he would have made of it?
Well, he was used to his music being constantly adapted and appearing in different versions and having different words being added. It's a casualty of his type of celebrity, and it happened continuously during his lifetime. So I doubt he would have been surprised, and to the extent that he got royalties sometimes, pleased.
but yet, you know, I mean, this, I knew so many. My own mother, this was just her favorite song. "My country's skies bluer than the ocean, sunlight shines on clover leaf and pine, but other lands have sunlight too and clover." This impulse, Daniel, to latch onto this piece, not in a nationalistic way, but in a peace way in the 60s, very interesting to me.
That's right. It's a composer's dream, of course, when a tune like this goes viral, and also a nightmare because they end up feeling they can't escape from it. But I think what's equally interesting is the way in which this kind of song also lends itself to images of landscapes. So people are associated with the pine trees, those north woods, lakes, fields of clover. It's that association of landscape and wide horizons that makes it so powerful.
He was quiet for the last 30 years of his life. Was it because he didn't like the way his work had been taken, or some other reason, Daniel?
There are many reasons, I think, to try and explain this curious 30-year silence. Maybe Sibelius felt that his natural creative life had finished by the end of the 1920s and that he really had nothing more to say. Some people also think that because he was addicted to alcohol and cigars, he wasn't physically capable of writing these large scores anymore. But I think also you can hear that tendency towards silence in lots of his late works. So maybe that 30 years of quiet was actually something he'd been aiming at or striving towards for a long time.
Quiet somehow related to the idea of the North, and we'll come back and look at that and much more. It's a privilege today to spend an hour talking about the music of Jean Sibelius, voice of Finland, voice of the North, and more. Daniel Grimley is with us, editor of Sibelius and His World. Christopher Gibbs is with us. He's co-artistic director of the Bard Summerscape Music Festival, where a great big celebration of Sibelius is on right now. Listeners, you can join us. Do you love that Sibelius stuck with tonal symphonic composition when Stravinsky and Schoenberg were shooting off into the future, or not? And how is it he's both so celebrated and called one of the worst? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Here's Sibelius's Symphony No. 7 in C major. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the music of Jean Sibelius, voice of Finland and the North, who's being celebrated in this couple of weeks by the Bard Summerscape Music Festival. Christopher Gibbs, co-artistic director of the festival, is with us today. He is author of The Life of Schubert, editor of the Musical Quarterly, professor of music at Bard College. Daniel Grimley is with us. He's editor of Sibelius and His World, professor of music at Oxford University, scholar in residence at the Bard Festival right now. Sibelius behind us here. Christopher Gibbs, tell us what we're listening to.
This is a rather unusual piece called Luonnontar, and it's a symphonic poem, but as you can hear, with soprano. And it's a short piece, around 9 minutes, that tells basically the creation story of from the Finnish epic, the Kalevala. And it's a quite haunting and difficult piece to sing, so it's not heard terribly often. And it, as we've been talking, that Sibelius is such a visual composer, it's also a little bit unusual to be having a vocal piece, particularly with an orchestral accompaniment.
But very, very beautiful. Listeners, you can join us this hour. What do you make of Sibelius? Was he a hero in your home growing up? What do you think of him today? And what is it that the far north, its images, its moods, brings to art? What's your word for your reaction to Sibelius? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Stephanie is calling. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was calling because this earlier this summer we had the opportunity to be in Helsinki and on a beautiful sunny Sunday, and we visited the monument that they have erected there to Sibelius. And in fact, it was very nice because they had a small group playing a part of Finlandia while we were there, which was really lovely addition. But the guide that had taken us there talked about how the monument that's there was misinterpreted by some to be a representation of organ pipes, and that the sculptress had actually had in mind when she put up these tubes of steel and brazed them that they were to represent the woods where Sibelius got his inspiration and where he did a lot of his mental composing and walking. And as she talked about how he seemed to hear the music in the woods or from the woods. And it occurred to me as she talked some more that he might actually have been a synesthete in one sense. That is, one of those people who has their brains that integrate two different senses at the same time. You know, some people see numbers and colors or letters and colors. And she talked about how he heard certain chords, certain colors inspired certain chords in his thinking about and in composing music. And I was thinking both in terms of how people get that same sense of the woods and the far north when they hear his music. But I was wondering if you all had some more information about how he was inspired by his walks in nature.
Yeah, let's go straight to it. It's a huge part of the reputation of Sibelius, a synesthete maybe here, Daniel Grimley. What do you say? And what about how he drew from nature? And was he happy to be understood that way?
I think that he was. Sibelius didn't really talk so much about what he thought his music actually meant. He wanted people just to make up their own mind and listen to the sound to themselves. But when he did try and notate some ideas in his diaries or in letters about what he thought his music meant or where he's getting ideas from, then he'd often turn to images of nature, of the sound of swans flying over his villa, the light on the water of a lakeside, the feeling of walking through the woods, this feeling of mood or atmosphere that he somehow tried to create in improvisations and then his compositions. So I think Stephanie is exactly right. There's that very strong synesthetic element in Sibelius's work.
How does that relate to what you describe as the idea of the North present in Sibelius's work and the work of other Scandinavian and Nordic artists? The idea of the North, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a good question, Tom. I think it's to do with a sense of mood or atmosphere, a kind of symbolist way of thinking about the world. And this is something that Sibelius shared with people like Edvard Munch, whose paintings, of course, are often very evocative.
The Scream and many others.
That's right. And if you look at what's behind the Scream in the foreground of that painting, then you see this luminous fjord lit by the light of a midsummer night. And Sibelius has that same sensitivity to particular times of day, particular colors, and a particular atmosphere that a landscape can evoke.
Let's get Abram in Brookline, Massachusetts on. Abram, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been very involved with Sibelius' music for decades and decades, having written and published a number of articles and record reviews.
Wonderful.
However, what I'm calling about is the subjective response to his music. While I'm delighted to listen to Sibelius any time during the year, I find I have a particular craving, subjective craving for his music during summer weather like this, when it's hot and humid, and one almost feels the Nordic blast coming through to one's body, almost the way one does when one drinks iced coffee or beer.
Yeah.
It is very cooling music and very powerful, and I can think of no other composer to whom I have that kind of bodily response. And I wonder if other people do. I mean, some of the callers are sort of suggesting that.
My Swedish grandfather, you know, he takes you to the cool here, Sibelius. My Swedish grandfather had that very kind of Nordic response to nature. You could tear up at birch trees and maybe be cooled down by Sibelius in the summer. You're feeling it viscerally. Christopher Gibbs, what do you say? A little Nordic breeze here in the summer in this music?
I don't know. We do the festival each year. This is the 22nd year of the Bard Music Festival, and we are so intent on each composer, it seems like the right time each year to be immersed in a particular figure. And this year, it's a lot of Sibelius.
There's a beauty in that. It can be taken in lots of directions. Daniel Grimley, you remind us here that there were some attempts to appropriate Sibelius's work by certain elements in the Third Reich in the late 1930s and 40s in Nazi circles. Give us that history.
That's right. Well, these associations of landscape and nature, purity, birch trees, open spaces, these are never neutral terms. They can always lend themselves to quite hardline political kinds of movements. And Finland was in a very special historical situation in the 1930s, a buffer zone between the Soviet Union on the one side and the growing aggression of the Nazi regime towards the south. And of course, they had a history of working with Germans after the Finnish Civil War. So the Germans saw an opportunity there to try and plug into this landscape imagery associated with Sibelius' work and use it really for their own ends.
Do we know what Sibelius thought of that?
Well, Sibelius always tried to maintain a careful distance between his music. Remember, he thought that his music was simply about sound and these kinds of political debates and contexts. So Sibelius was a weather vane, but he wasn't really interested in nailing his flag to any particular political banner.
Other than Finnish nationalism?
I mean, other than his own music, really. That's all. By the 1930s, his own music was all that he was really interested in.
But early on, did he see himself as a banner carrier for Finland's independence, for its national
I think he
freedom?
Saw that as a role that was thrust upon him and one that he was happy to work with. But as early as the Third Symphony, which of course we heard earlier this hour, you can feel him pushing away from that kind of narrow nationalist idiom towards something that has a more universal reach and appeal.
You can hear this is Neville Cardis in the Manchester Guardian writing in the newspaper in 1958. Sibelius justified the austerity of his old age by saying that while other composers were engaged in manufacturing cocktails, he offered the public pure, cold water. Sounds Nordic. That word pure can get tricky in political terms at the same time. Gabe in Alston, Massachusetts. Gabe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a violinist and a music antiquarian, the manuscript dealer. Two comments for both sides of my life.
Yes, please. Wonderful.
As a manuscript dealer, one of the things I encounter most frequently on the market are letters of thanks from Sibelius to people who have sent him cigars. There must be hundreds of them floating around.
Amazing.
And people seem to call and email about them with kind of amazing regularity. It's just amazing to think of so many people all over the world.
Big smoker, big drinker, but very happy for those cigars in the mail, I guess.
Yeah. He famously adored them, and people knew it. And it's kind of amazing, I think, of a time when people would send their favorite composer a gift like that randomly through the mail.
Oh,
he always seemed to thank them with a personal letter.
I love that note, Gabe, and only you perhaps would have it for us, and I appreciate your sharing it so much. Let me get one more here. Thank you, Gabe. Saranac Lake, New York. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hello.
I was a student at the Juilliard School in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, and Sibelius was one of my favorite people to listen to. And if you expressed a like for Sibelius to that crowd of composers, they looked upon you with a disdain that was pretty strong.
Why?
And I'm glad to see that over the years since then, the change in the attitude towards a composer of his stature.
What was the disdain about in those years, George, in the 40s?
He was fusty and crusty and old-fashioned, and nobody really wanted to listen to any of that because Stravinsky and Schoenberg and all of those people were the important composers, and he was not important to these people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's changed, and I'm delighted. And thank you for having this program.
Oh, I'm very happy to do it, George. Let's listen to some more from his final symphony. Well, there's talk of an eighth that went up in flames. We'll look at that. But here is Sibelius, Symphony No. 7, C major, breaking from traditional norms, composing his last, his most famous symphony in just one movement. This recording is from Leon Botstein and the American Symphony Orchestra at New York's Lincoln Center in 2002. The last symphony, Symphony No. 7 from Sibelius. Symphony No. 7, the last from Sibelius. Christopher Gibbs, what are we hearing here in the evolution of his work? And what about our caller's observation that at Juilliard in the 40s, Sibelius was seen as work was seen as old and fusty? Is there a reconsideration? I know Milan Kundera at one point talked about his approach to be that of anti-modern modernism. So modern even if it didn't fit the mainstream of modernism.
Yes, what's fascinating is the high modernist music that was getting a lot of the prestige and that was being taught was, of course, not being listened to with a great deal of affection by the public. And it really has more and more disappeared with the revival of interest in figures like Rachmaninoff or Sibelius, Elgar. And in some ways, their music now seems prescient more of postmodern music, of minimalism, of what's called spectral music. So, in fact, Sibelius is much more in touch with and in line with and prefigures composers that are writing today and that have been writing for the past 20 years or so than really Schoenberg or even perhaps Stravinsky.
It's kind of amazing. Sandy in Williamsburg, Virginia, you're on the air. Sandy, thanks for joining us. Hi.
I just wanted to share this. I was listening to your broadcast, and when I heard the Finlandia,
yes,
it reminded me that I went to an all-African-American high school, mm-hmm. and our alma mater was written to this music.
Yes.
And it was written by a guidance counselor at our school, and I don't know what year it was written, but thank you for that. When I heard it, it was like, oh, my gosh, I never knew what it was.
And there you were at an African-American school with the
Hackamack, Virginia.
Yeah, and the melody of our Finnish Sibelius as the tune of your school song. And why not? There is a universality there, too, Sandy.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for this.
I appreciate your call very much. We're going to hear one more piece before we go out here. And this is a a live broadcast conducted by Sibelius himself, a radio broadcast on January 1st, 1939. This is after a long silence, publishing none of his work since this Tapiola had first come out. Here in 39, he conducts Andante Festivo. It's the only recording of the composer interpreting his own work. Let's listen. Under the baton of Sibelius himself in 1929, that beautiful emotionality, or that too sweet, too rich emotionality, as you will. Christopher Gibbs, what do your younger musicians think of Sibelius today?
He's very popular. We did at the Bard Conservatory the first symphony this year with great success, and a lot of our students are coming to the festival. We had an open rehearsal where the entire freshman class of 500 students came for the Fifth Symphony and singing along with Finlandia, and we're mesmerized by the music.
Well, it's been an education and a pleasure for us today to hear all the receptions to this music and the background behind it. We're grateful to the two of you for being with us. Christopher Gibbs, co-artistic director of the Bard Summerscape Music Festival. Good luck with the remainder of the festival, and thank you so much for being with us today, Mr. Gibbs.
Thanks for having us.
And Daniel Grimley, professor of music at Oxford University, editor of Sibelius and His World. Daniel Grimley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
We'll go out once more with Finlandia, conducted here by Leon Botstein, performed by the American Symphony Orchestra from Jean Sibelius. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.